loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the European Commission yesterday hit technology firm Google with a record $5 billion fine, saying the company had used its Android mobile operating system to illegally cement its dominant position in searches. Google said it would appeal, even though it is currently sitting on $103 billion in cash. Next, Maria Butina, the Russian graduate student who was arrested and charged with failing to register as a foreign agent, was arraigned today in federal court in Washington, where she pleaded not guilty. The U.S. government says that Butina was in touch with Russian intelligence officials, an accusation she has denied through her attorney. Then, the president of the European Investment Bank said today that the organization would put its global operations at risk by investing in Iran, calling into question European efforts to salvage the Iran nuclear deal that Washington already has walked away from. Meanwhile, the Iranian government announced that it has built a new factory that can produce rotors for as many as 60 new centrifuges per day. And then British Prime Minister Theresa May said today that any Brexit plan must be, quote, workable, unquote, as she was criticized from both the right and the left for the bitter divisions within her own Conservative Party that seemed to be preventing forward movement in leaving the European Union. May is particularly stuck on the issues of trade and open borders. And finally, Israel appears to be preparing more and more for direct hostilities with Syria, as control of Syrian government territory in the country's southwest near the Golan Heights and the border with Israel shifts from rebels to the government. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. The European Commission yesterday hit technology firm Google with a record $5 billion fine, saying the company had used its mobile operating system to illegally cement its dominant position in searches. Google said it would appeal, even though it's currently sitting on $103 billion in cash. We're joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Dr. Robert Epstein, and welcome back.
It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. So let's start off by asking you this. What's the big deal if people default to Google's browser rather than some other browser?
Well, you have to think back to, you know, the old days when everyone was going after Microsoft. And the problem there was the bundling. So Microsoft bundled its browser, Internet Explorer, which now almost no one uses, with its operating system. And so basically, you know, everyone was kind of forced to use its browser. And, you know, that's the same kind of issue operating here, is that because Android dominates mobile computing. In other words, if you have a mobile device other than Apple, almost certainly you're using a Google operating system, Android. And then basically Google controls lots of things that you're going to do, including the kind of online search you're going to conduct. So that's the fundamental problem here that the EU was addressing, which is this bundling and basically violating European law by forcing people to use certain products all made by Google.
Well, I'm wondering also about the effect that this fine will have on Google. They have so much money in cash, and this is
I'm just looking at the stock market, by the way.
Yeah,
since
tell me.
Google owner Alphabet is up 0.44% despite the news of the European Commission's 4.34 billion euro fine, which was
there
about
is.
$5 billion.
There it is right there.
It's not tanking. It's up.
See, we should have bought.
Well, you know, you have to keep in mind, too, that there's a lot going on here behind the scenes. This is a huge fine. There could be, on top of this huge fine, there could be penalties up to 5% of Google's daily revenue. This fine, by the way, is pretty much the maximum the European Union can levy, because it is really 5% of Google's revenue for the year. So I don't even care if you have $100 billion in the bank. That's a big hit. And as far as Alphabet goes, there are other issues here. This is complicated. Because Google has been basically under intense scrutiny from multiple agencies, especially the European Commission. Google has gone through two corporate reorganizations since 2015 to try to protect its assets and to try to bolster its stock. And if anything, that's what you're seeing happening today mm-hmm. in the stock market. It's the result of these corporate reorganizations that has distancing, believe it or not, the Google search engine and Android, it's distancing it from the parent company, Alphabet. There are now two parent companies, believe it or not. There's Alphabet and 26, which are separate entities. So things are complicated here, but the point is, there's no question now that I would say the floodgates are open because it's not just the EU that's going to be going after Google now. In the U.S., I believe the FTC, the DOJ are both. They're seeing dollar signs here, and they have cause, just as the EU did. They have cause under U.S. law to go after Google very aggressively, and they see money here.
Google chief executive Sundar Pichai blogged a response. Quote, rapid innovation, wide choice, and falling prices are classic hallmarks of robust competition, and Android has enabled all of them. Today's decision rejects the business model that supports Android, which has created more choice for everyone, not less. How would you respond, Dr. Epstein?
I think that's laughable, absolutely laughable. I mean, in the mobile market, Android is a super monopoly, number one. Number two, Android, as products go, is disgusting. It's not a product. It's a surveillance platform that monitors everything people do, whether they're online or offline. I've written about this. This is why Google decided to buy and develop Android and to go into mobile computing in the first place, because they weren't getting enough information when people were offline. So Android is a super surveillance platform monitoring what people do online and offline, and it's very easy to show, by the way, with a man in the middle device. It's very easy to show that if you're offline and you're just roaming around town and doing this and that, but you're offline, the moment you go back online with an Android device, it uploads instantly to Google information about everything you've been doing during the few hours you were offline. That's crazy.
I think probably next to no one knows that. I mean, if people knew that, I think that they would try to take steps to prevent it
and,
from happening.
That's a shocking piece of news, although maybe we shouldn't be surprised, because each one of these shocking pieces of information comes in such rapid form. But Dr. Epstein, again, let's talk, because all of us are using, not all of us, but most are using so-called smartphones. If Android is bad, if Google phones are bad, is Apple better? Is an iPhone better in this regard?
An iPhone is better. Tim Cook, the head of Apple, has actually gone on record recently objecting to the business model that Google and Facebook use, which I call the surveillance business model, or SBM, and BM, of course, can be interpreted in a different way too. And the point is, Tim Cook. Tim Cook has gone on record objecting to that business model. He says it's not a legitimate model for business, where you turn users into the product and you have no actual product, and everything, all these services people are getting are not really services. They're just gussied up surveillance platforms. That's all they are. Android is just outrageous. And it's so easy to demonstrate, what Android is doing, that I'm really shocked that more people aren't aware. But in my opinion, you have to be crazy to using any kind of Android device. You have to be nuts.
So again, I want to, because everybody's got an iPhone or an Android,
yeah,
right?
One or the
so
other.
I want to keep with this for a moment. So, okay, why, just again, explain for the lay audience, the people who don't know anything, like me and John, for instance.
Yes,
John, am I speaking for you all right?
Yes, you are.
Okay. For us.
So modest.
So why, if you have an iPhone and you're offline, why is it that Apple doesn't know where you are, what you've done, and accumulated all that data on you, but Google does.
Well, first of all, I have to say that you know, Google's surveillance business model has been so profitable. It's such an easy way to make lots of money that at this point, thousands of companies are drifting in that direction. I would guess even Apple has drifted a little bit in that direction. Now, having said that, you just have to go online and look at their annual reports to see the huge difference here between a company like Apple and a company like Google. With Google, more than 90% of their revenues, according to their own published data, still come from advertising. We are the product that they're advertising, okay? We are the product. But with Apple and Microsoft, still more than 90% of their revenue comes from selling actual products, actual, you know, devices, gizmos. I mean, you know, the iPhone, the iPad, they sell products. So that's the difference, you know? I mean, that 90% selling us versus 90% selling products, that's a huge difference in the way you go about
that is
doing
huge
business.
It is. And then how is it through the Google tower? I mean, through the cell phone towers, how are they accumulating data on you when you're offline? How does it work?
Well, because of again, that's why, if you look at my piece called Google's Gotcha, which I published in U.S. News and World Report, it's a pretty clear kind of picture of how this is all working. It's because when you're offline with an Android device, pretty much everything you do on the device is being recorded, number one. Number two, as long as your location feature is enabled, and of course everyone has it enabled all the time, and even when you're offline, that feature is still enabled, then wherever you go, your location is being tracked and recorded inside the phone. So the thing is that when you go back online, all the information that has accumulated during all those hours when you're offline, it's instantly uploaded. Now, by the way, this works even if you take out your SIM card and then you just go around town. It doesn't matter. The Android operating system is still recording most of what you're doing and your location. And the moment you put the SIM card back in and reconnect to your mobile provider or to Wi-Fi, the Android phone instantly uploads the information. Now, this is no big secret, and it's really easy to demonstrate. If you have the budget, these days now you can buy a man-in-the-middle device for, I think, under $200, and you can actually do this yourself. In fact, you might even do it because I think your listeners would just love it. You know, snap some pictures and, you know, put them on your website and just show people how this works. Because, as I say, your head will spin when you see how this works and how easy it is to demonstrate. It's not a subtle thing. I mean, this is just outrageous, massive, aggressive surveillance, which, in my opinion, should be illegal. And yeah, I think the whole SBM should be illegal.
We're all at risk here. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from San Diego by Dr. Robert Epstein. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Maria Butina, the Russian graduate student who was arrested and charged with failing to register as a foreign agent, was arraigned today in federal court in Washington, where she pleaded not guilty. The U.S. government says that Butina was in touch with Russian intelligence officials, an accusation she has denied through her attorney. We're joined from Washington, from the courthouse, by Alex Rubenstein. He is a Sputnik News analyst and journalist, and you can find his work on Twitter at RealAlexRuby, R-U-B-I. Alex attended today's arraignment. Alex, let me frame this real briefly, and then you correct me if I'm wrong. Maria Butina is a graduate student here in Washington. She was very active in her graduate school, bringing together Americans and non-Americans, including Russians. She was getting a master's degree in international affairs, so she had a focus on international affairs, and that's what people would be talking about. And she was able to make inroads, make contacts into organizations like CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee, or the NRA, the National Rifle Association. And she, for that reason, came to the attention of the FBI, which convinced itself somehow that she is a spy or working on behalf of a spy for the Russian government. So she was charged with two crimes, both of which are relatively minor crimes. One is failure to register as a foreign agent, which people in Washington do every day. And the other is conspiracy, which can frankly mean whatever the government wants it to mean. And what makes this different is that today the government asked the judge to hold Maria Butina without bond, just like they would a mass murderer or someone who has committed treason or some kind of heinous violent crime. What are you hearing at the courthouse, and how is this playing out today?
Well, it was interesting how it played out. It actually felt like it might be the 1980s. I mean, first you had during the proceedings, there was a very quick arraignment prior to Butina coming up. And that was a black man who came out in an orange jumpsuit who was arraigned within 5 minutes. Bond was denied for him. And then Butina came out. And the government basically made the case that because of the alleged connection to the Russian government, she presented a flight risk because, say, she would enter a diplomat's vehicle, she would have immunity from being detained in that vehicle, and that they could drive to the embassy compound and give her a new passport if she was released on the condition that she turn over her passport. So the government accepted that argument, which was, in my opinion, unusual because, Butina's defense attorney, Mr. Robert Driscoll, argued that, you know, if any Russian national or any national of a government that does not have an extradition treaty with the United States were to be detained, were to be facing a detention hearing, what would make her different from that? That remains unproven because, I mean, she hasn't gone to trial yet. So Brazil, for example, doesn't have a extradition treaty with the United States. So and the law is that her bond needs to be considered on an individual level, not based on whether or not she may be given favor by diplomats who would protect her.
So was the decision made right there in court to deny her bond?
Yes.
It was. So it's not as though the judge is going to consider both sides' arguments. The judge just made the decision and it's done.
Well, no. I mean, both sides did get opportunities to present an argument. Actually, the government brought in a officer of the Department of Justice who works in diplomatic security, who testified about these issues that I raised earlier. And he asked the witness a number of questions. And when it was the defense's turn to cross-interrogate, the defense asked one question. That question was, have you ever seen Maria Butina at the Russian embassy? And that was objected to by the government, and the judge sustained that objection. One thing that was interesting was images, a selfie that Maria Butina took on Inauguration Day in front of the Capitol building was showed to everybody in court, reporters included. She took it right in front of the Capitol building. And apparently this Russian official who is believed to be Mr. Torshin was actually referenced by the defense by name. She sent that to him and he apparently replied to her that she was a daredevil. Another picture was shown of Maria Butina having dinner at a DC restaurant with a person who is believed to be a Russian intelligence officer. He was expelled from the U.S. Amid that diplomatic row maybe a year ago under Obama, I believe. And yet another picture was referenced. It wasn't shown, but it was her meeting with Sergei Kislyak. Now, that meeting was it wasn't even a meeting. It was a picture that she had taken with him at the Russian Cultural Center in Washington, D.C. after a film screening.
Kislyak was the Russian ambassador to the United States. So a lot of Russians in Washington, or a lot of Russians around the country, gravitate to their own embassy, or they'll go to his cultural or social functions. Kislyak was a man around town, not that shocking. In the criminal complaint, Alex, and we're talking with Alex Rubenstein from the courthouse where Maria Butina, the Russian 29-year-old college graduate student who's charged with being an unregistered foreign agent for Russia and was seeking, it seemed like from all the documents, wanting to improve U.S.-Russian relations and to make contacts, something that I think every country, John, does. I mean—
Absolutely, yes.
Or people from all countries do. I mean, everybody wants to have better relations with the United States and their country. Maybe she's working with the Russian government, maybe not. But here's what she's actually, in the complaint, it says, there's only 3 points in the complaint. This in the overt acts part of the complaint. They say it's a conspiracy to represent Russian interests in the United States. On or about March 14, 2016, Butina emailed a U.S. person in an effort to develop, maintain, and exploit a relationship in furtherance of the conspiracy. The conspiracy was the conspiracy to improve relations. Number two, she came here as a student, and yet she continued to try to do these things, network, as her lawyer says, to improve relations. And the third and final point of the complaint was on or about September 26, Butina emailed a U.S. person to organize an event for the purpose of influencing the views of U.S. officials as those views relate to the Russian Federation. In other words, they have a more positive view towards Russia. So she sent two emails, and she came here as a student. Those are the three overt acts of the criminal
and
complaint.
And that makes a conspiracy. That's a conspiracy
because
to do something.
Because it's, as you said, a conspiracy is whatever the government wants it to. Now, Alex, I want to read from the documents, the court documents. Here's what they say. They arrested her because they said, and now I want to, this is relevant because they say they're denying her bond so that she won't flee. But that's also why they arrested her. The impression left in the mainstream media was that she was perhaps fleeing Russia. But here, I want to read from the documents. Butina was taking steps to leave the Washington, D.C. area. Finally, in the days leading up to her arrest, Butina was observed by the FBI taking steps consistent with a plan to leave the Washington, D.C. area and possibly the United States. First, Butina applied for a B-1, B-2 visa, which would allow her to travel to and from the United States. Okay, she would have a visa. And on July 14, 2018, Butina and a U.S. person number one were followed to a U-Haul truck rental facility where blah, 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 case number. They inquired about renting a moving truck and purchased moving boxes. When agents executed a warrant at their Washington, D.C. apartment on July 25th, 2018, the defendant's belongings were packed and a letter was discovered notifying the landlord that the lease was to be terminated on July 31st, 2018. Alex Rubenstein, I know you are a crackerjack journalist, and that's why I want to ask you this important question. Can you get to Russia on a U-Haul truck?
No, I don't think you can. I think there's several bodies of water you'd need to cross first. Actually, it came out in court that she was planning on moving to South Dakota to live with her boyfriend who lives there. So that's total bogus.
Fleeing to live with her boyfriend in a U-Haul truck, they had to arrest her. It's so clear.
In South Dakota. Right, right. And, you know, the other thing about this, you know, the government was arguing that there was this flight risk. But, you know, her house was raided by more than a dozen FBI officers with guns drawn. And she didn't flee at that point.
That was back in April or something, right?
Right, right. And she gave 8-hour testimony to the Senate Intelligence Committee, and she didn't flee after that. She didn't flee before that. So the defense's argument was, you know, this case is unique because it shows that she's not going to flee. And I'm sympathetic to that. You know, the other thing that I want to bring up is that thousands and thousands of messages between Butina and Alexander Korshin, who is a official at a Russian-owned bank. He's a gun rights activist as well. He's her mentor, so to speak. And they've exchanged thousands and thousands of messages. The government didn't choose the messages that were about how to buy toothpaste in the United States. They didn't share the messages that were about, you know, appropriate gifts for his children that she was seeking to buy. They chose ones that could be taken out of context to show that she was acting under his direction. And
yeah, they always
even
do.
If she were acting under his direction, I mean, I think it's unlikely, but if she were, his direction is not the Kremlin. His direction, his agenda is actually very different from the Kremlin's. He's pro-gun, and as you can see, as everyone knows, gun rights are very restrictive in Russia.
I think she was also endorsed by Putin's main opponent, Navalny. So anyway, this is a strange story. The arrest was timed to coincide with the Helsinki summit. I don't think that was a coincidence. But John, we are completely out of time.
We're out of time. We were joined from Washington by Alex Rubenstein. He is a Sputnik News analyst and journalist, and you can find his work on Twitter at RealAlexRuby. He was at today's arraignment. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. The president of the European Investment Bank said today that the organization would put its global operations at risk by investing in Iran, calling into question European efforts to salvage the Iran nuclear deal that Washington already has walked away from. Meanwhile, the Iranian government announced that it has built a new factory that can produce rotors for as many as 60 new centrifuges per day. We're joined from London by Shabir Rezvi. He's an economist and a political analyst, and we're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome to both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Happy to be here.
Shabir, let's start with you. I think this this announcement by the European Investment Bank probably was not surprising, but it was also at the same time disappointing and very important. Is there any future that you can see, at least in the near term, for any European investment in Iran?
Well, look, the European Investment Bank hasn't really invested anything significantly. If I recall correctly, even in the last 3 years, they really haven't invested directly at all in Iran. There hasn't been foreign direct investment coming through EIB, if you like. However, there have been sort of investments from provincial German banks who have no exposure to the U.S. market. So for EIB, saying this at this particular juncture is perhaps more politics than commerce. Of course, with Trump's announcement, and we are really literally weeks away when the new sanctions come into force. So possibly the EIB is hedging its bets by announcing this particular formula that they will not be investing in Iran. But overall, I think there has been a schism that is taking place between Europe and the USA, as you well recall that during the last week, Mr. Trump has been to NATO, and he has unruffled many feathers there with numerous European Union leaders and of the NATO members. And secondly, he was in UK also last Friday, bad omen day, 13th of Friday the 13th, and he didn't have a very good reception here either. So I don't know. But there are other countries who are very happy to continue to do business with Iran, whether it's Russia, China, India, and a number of Far Eastern countries, including a number of BRIC countries. So I don't know where this is leading Europe, if you like. I don't know whether Europe and America are playing good cop, bad cop situation, but really Europe has to deliver if they are really serious about continuing with the nuclear deal that was reached way back in 2015.
Walter, we haven't really seen yet from the U.S. government how complicated this is going to be and how tough the Treasury Department is going to be on these smaller banks that Shabir just mentioned continue to do business with Iran. Now, everybody knows that pretty much every international financial transaction makes its way through the United States somehow, usually by some wire transfer or computer movement of funds or whatever it is. Everything for one reason or another, comes through the United States. So do you think that this policy is going to be strict enough, strong enough, enforced strictly enough that the Treasury Department will actually go after those European banks and companies that continue to do business with Iran?
What makes the U.S. sanctions against Iran, and they have similar sanctions against other countries too, is, of course, so aggressive is that they're extraterritorial in character, right? So they're not just saying, well, nobody can do business with Iran. It's, or, you know, we won't do business with Iran itself. It doesn't just target Iran. It targets anybody who does business with Iran. And, you know, Donald Trump called the sanctions that they were unrolling, you know, the toughest sanctions ever. And so I think that even though, of course, with any sanctions regimes, there's a great deal of discretion that authorities can use whether or not to impose the fines and penalties that exist, I think that the signals from the Trump administration, given their really since the beginning of Trump's term in office, have focused so heavily on affecting regime change in Iran, I do anticipate them enforcing it quite tightly. And, you know, they'll have to weigh that against geopolitical factors. So, for instance, India, I think, is an interesting case because India is one of the main purchasers of Iranian oil. They're collaborating with Iran to build a port. But the Modi government, the right-wing Hindu nationalist government, has been cozying up to the United States to a very great degree. And there's a number of complicated calculations that are going on there. And other countries are dealing with similar calculations. Well, how worth it is it really to upset the United States by continuing to do our business with Iran? And I think it's clear that the European countries have already made that calculation. And so what does Iran have to do? Well, they have to respond. They have to do things like their announcement today, where they'll be stepping up or preparing to step up the production of centrifuges that would be used in different nuclear processes. There's been, I think, a great unification of the Iranian government, where, you know, there used to be quite a bit of tension between the government of President Rouhani and the office of the Supreme Leader. Now that seems to have gone away. But of course, there are tensions forming in Iranian society itself as the sanctions start to bite, as economic deprivation starts to set in.
Shabir, let's go back to you. Can you explain to us what this announcement means from the Iranians, that they have opened a new factory that can manufacture rotors for as many as 60 new centrifuges a day? How important is that?
But look, you've got to look at the whole history of Iran's nuclear development. Iran has very clearly, adamantly, and categorically said over the years that Iran is not interested in producing nuclear armaments. The only requirement is for energy so that they could diversify with the dependence on the oil and other sectors. What is interestingly happening is that when the Supreme Leader issues a ruling, a fatwa, or a requirement from an Islamic perspective that Iran is not interested in nuclear armament, that particular sort of statement is ignored by global leaders. Whilst on the other hand, if the previous Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, issues a fatwa against Salman Rushdie, that is seen as a fatwa to kill Salman Rushdie. So there is this dichotomy that Islam and the religious authorities in Iran are not interested, will not, and have no intention of developing nuclear weapons. I just really can't understand why the world leaders cannot understand this. However, because they want to portray Iran as a bogeyman, and since the advent of the Islamic Revolution, sanctions have been applied continuously. So it's not that the new sanctions that are going to come in are going to cripple Iran. I think Iran has quite remarkably sustained the sanctions for the last 38 odd years. Mm-hmm. And as the Supreme Leader has quite confidently said that this is a resistance economy which is developing, and Iran is developing its agriculture very well. At this moment, 80% of its wheat requirements are produced internally. Most of the domestic consumer products are produced in Iran. Yes, of course, it has an impact on pharmaceutical products or medical products which are needed to be imported, hence foreign currency is required for that. However, your colleague earlier commented that most of the global transactions, the banking and the financial services transactions, have to be routed through New York or London. And that's where Iran has been out of the SWIFT system, therefore has not been able to benefit from having these transactions. But there are a whole host of barter deals that can be done. And although the Indian right-wing government of Modi is sort of cozying up to USA, and not only USA, but to Tel Aviv at the same time. Mm-hmm. But India imports 20% of its oil requirements from Iran. And even over the previous sanctions period, India has not budged from doing trade with Iran because Indian economy is a growing economy. They want to continuously progress and improve the lot of their people. And on the other hand, you've got China. China, only a couple of months ago, gave a tranche of $12 billion to the central bank in Iran for facilitating transactions between China and India. So I think Iran is not in a precarious position, as perhaps some analysts and commentators may think. And I believe that the loser in this particular transaction will be the USA. And I think that's where the big problem is, that for the last 38 years, American companies have not been able to benefit from the energy sector, car manufacturing, other sort of sectors that are very, very important in Iran, which American companies have had to bypass because of the sanctions that would be applied. And I think that same fear and paranoia is being created for the European Union companies.
Well, we are going to leave it there. That was the voice of Shabir Ezvi. He's an economist and political analyst based in London. And we were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
British Prime Minister Theresa May said today that any Brexit plan must be, quote, workable, unquote, as she was criticized from both the right and the left for the bitter divisions within her own Conservative Party that seem to be preventing forward movement in leaving the European Union. May is particularly stuck on the issues of trade and open borders. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Alexander, I have to tell you, there was a marked difference in coverage of Brexit here in the United States just over the past 4 or 5 days. 4 or 5 days ago, it was all very orderly, maybe slightly unfriendly in terms of Boris Johnson criticizing the prime minister. But today's press seems to indicate that it is just a mess over there. What's happening with Brexit?
Well, I think the answer is that it is a mess over here because quite clearly the government has not got a clear idea of what he wants to do. Theresa May has been coming up with ever more complicated and intricate plans as she tries to reconcile all the various factions within her party, her Conservative Party, pro-European and anti-European factions, and tries to hold her government together. And what she's quickly discovering is that she simply can't do that. She can't please everybody. And by trying to please everybody, she's pleasing no one and is putting her own position in jeopardy and is making the process of negotiation with the EU unbelievably difficult. So I think a mess is probably the more accurate way to describe it. In fact, if you look at the British media and the way it's been talked about here, that is certainly the view of most people here. It's also the view of the British public if you follow opinion polls.
Go ahead.
No, you're right.
I just wanted to follow up on that very quickly. Is the issue here open borders, or is it trade with the EU or with the United States, or is it something deeper? Is it that the populace is having second thoughts about the very nature of Brexit and what it means over the long term?
I think the underlying problem is that in June 2016, the British public, in a referendum, voted by a narrow majority, to leave the European Union, but that the British political establishment was neither prepared for that decision and did not expect it. And most of it, the greater majority of them, including, in fact, Theresa May, fundamentally think it's wrong. So I think they're having real problems working out how to move forward, doing something that they are committed to doing, but with which they fundamentally disagree. Now, as to what the issue is, the issue probably, from Theresa May's point of view, is trade, in the sense that she wants to preserve trade between Britain and the European Union at essentially existing levels. The problem is, doing that requires concessions to the European Union, which are unacceptable to the hardline Brexiters, and it might also lead to demands from the European Union for freedom of movement, which the European Union in general treats as inseparable from the question of freedom of trade within the European area. So I'm afraid May has got herself into a terrible mess trying to sort of preserve trading relations at the same level as before whilst pressing ahead with Brexit. And I think that's really where all the problem is.
So the quid pro quo, again, we're saying this for an American audience, which won't really know. The quid pro quo in the European Union is that the different countries that were part of the free movement of capital from one country to another and the free movement of people from one country to another allowed for trade to take place without a complicated sets of tariffs or taxes or, you know, going back to the feudal era, weights and measures. In other words, a real free trade zone that would allow, it's sort of a corporate-based system of globalization that accrues benefits to different countries or capital in different countries, and in some cases for people in different countries, certainly in terms of flexibility, in terms of where they want to live. If Brits wanted to go to a warmer climate, they could move to Spain, and other people could from Eastern Europe could move to the UK looking for higher wage jobs. There were benefits for people. But the hardline Brexiters are really saying, look, if we're leaving the EU, we're leaving the EU. That means, in essence, not the free flow of capital and certainly not the free flow of people. What do they want? And what would, if their program was enacted, what would it achieve? What would it look like for the people in the UK?
I think there's a number of points to make here. I mean, the European Union conceives of itself as a single economic unit. It conceives of itself as an economic unit where, as you correctly say, capital, people, and goods move around freely, just as they move around in other economic units, like, for example, the United States. The problem is, the major difference is that because the European Union isn't a state like the United States is, regulations to operate this economic unit are not decided by a democratically elected government, but by a technocracy which has become extremely neoliberal in its ideology. So it tends to support very much free market solutions for business and minimum regulation increasingly for workers, and increasingly also it is very opposed to public ownership and a public subsidy. So that, I think, explains what the European Union is. Now, the hardline Brexiters in Britain are, it should be said clearly, a very divided group of people. They, too, have never really decided exactly what it is that they want. What they all collectively want, the one thing they're all agreed about, is that they don't want any more free movement of people from Europe into Britain. There is conflict between them about to what extent they want free movement of goods and capital between the European Union and Britain. Some of them are more hawkish about that than others. But asking them what it is exactly that they want is actually not really very clear. many of them seem to speak of Britain detaching itself completely from Europe and trading with the European Union as if it was a completely separate country trading with the European Union, which is, as I said, a single economic unit. So two economic units trading with each other. But they've never really spelled out exactly how that would work or what processes that would need, given that Britain has been a part of this single European economic unit now for a long time, and the British economy is essentially a part of the larger British European economy. So if Theresa May is confused, many of her opponents are confused also, which is why we have the mess that we have.
Let me ask you, too, why is Boris Johnson so opposed to something that would be akin to a soft landing? Why is he so opposed to easy trade between the UK and the EU and more supportive of easy trade between the UK and the US? What's the difference?
Right. Again, I think there's a lot of things to unpack here. I mean, if we specifically talk about Boris Johnson, I think a great deal of what he is doing is partly tactical maneuvering as he seeks to replace Theresa May as leader of the Conservative Party and as Prime Minister. So he is appealing to the hardline Brexiters whose support he wants so that he can one day become Prime Minister. But going to the more, the bigger question, if you look at Brexit and how it all began, it began with some people in Britain very suspicious of the EU because they saw the EU as a possible rival to the United States, which as extreme Atlanticists they didn't like, and seeing a role for Britain in closer economic partnership with the United States. That was extremely popular position amongst them a few years ago. It's now become much more difficult to pursue because, of course, they have in Donald Trump, a president of the United States who seems to be less interested in reaching out to countries like Britain and who seems to be moving towards more protectionist positions. So it's become a more difficult position for them to follow. But there is a residual loyalty, if you wish, to the United States and to support for closer connection to the United States. And if I might go back a little bit to the point where it all crystallized, in my opinion, around the time of the Iraq War, when France and Germany, the two leaders of the European Union, opposed the US attack on Iraq, and of course Britain supported it. And that made these, as I said, hardline Brexiters feel that they were closer to the United States than to what they were to the European Union and were concerned that the European Union was becoming a rival to the United States instead of a partner with it.
Alexander Mercuris is our guest. Alexander, we have 30 seconds left, and then, John, you'll have to take us out. But real quick, Alexander, May's Brexit plan narrowly survived in the vote in Parliament. Will she survive? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what's your guess?
No one can do. But my own personal view is that the time is running out for her very fast, because I mean she only got through that vote with the support of some MPs, five MPs from the opposition Labour Party. She's having increasing problems holding her own party together, and she's increasingly looking as if she's unable to hold it together. And when that happens, the position of a British Prime Minister becomes extremely insecure, and authority, and in the end, their position collapses very fast. And I think we're in the early stages of seeing that with May.
Okay, that was the voice of Alexander Mercuris. He joined us from London. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Israel appears to be preparing more and more for direct hostilities with Syria as control of Syrian territory in the country's southwest near the Golan Heights and the border with Israel shifts from rebels to
to the Government. We're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Rick, good to talk to you again.
Good to be here, guys.
Rick, there has been some territorial shift in Syria over the past few days. Near the Golan Heights, immediately east of the Golan Heights, which of course are occupied by Israel and have been for many years. And we just got word, not carried in the mainstream media, but in other outlets this morning, that what appears to be an Israeli weapons cache was found inside Syrian territory. Can you tell our listeners what's happening in southwestern Syria right now?
Right. Well, the city of Daraa has been taken by the Syrian government, recaptured in the last week. A lot of the so-called rebels have reconciled. They've basically turned in their weapons, and they're accepting the reconciliation agreement with the government. Others have been sent in buses to Idlib in the north of Syria. But the big news is that the large town, very close to the border with Jordan, Daraa, is now completely under the control of the Syrian government. Now, this report that you're referring to about Israeli-made bombs having been discovered, that's in Hama, which is in the middle of the country, to the north of Homs, actually. And so that was apparently a big weapons cache of ISIS, known as Daesh. But this is just more confirmation of the material support that Israel has been providing to the terrorist groups that have been operating in Syria since 2011.
Rick Sterling, let's follow up on that, because undoubtedly, some people will say, wait a second, that's a conspiracy theory. You're saying that the Israeli government is supporting the soldiers, the fighters of the Islamic State, so-called Islamic State, ISIS. What would you say to them when they say, look, that's just too much. That's a bridge too far. That's a conspiracy theory, unprovable.
Well, the path is fluid between Nusra, between the Free Syrian Army, between ISIS. People have shifted. Fighters have shifted, both foreign fighters and to the extent there's also been Syrians involved. They have moved at different times. Different groups have paid more per fighter, and they've attracted fighters because they were advancing the most or whatever. But there's been a lot of basically faulty analysis from early on that Israel was not heavily invested in the conflict, it was claimed that Israel didn't mind the Assad government in Damascus. That was very faulty. Israel has been providing material support. They've been medically treating fighters who were associated with Jabhat al-Nusra, the official al-Qaeda branch. And there's video showing Benjamin Netanyahu alongside some of these fighters in the Golan Heights. Israel has attacked the Syrian army as they were attacking the terrorists near in southern Syria, and so this latest news about Israeli-made bombs being found in an ISIS weapons cache is just another piece of evidence which goes along with all the other evidence.
You know, I have to ask too. The first time I ever went to Israel and Syria. Well, the first time I went to Damascus, there was an incident where two Israeli jets buzzed the presidential palace in Damascus. And I went from Damascus to Israel in a crazy roundabout way through Austria, because it was the only way to get there.
Oh, you took the old Austrian route.
Right. And the Israelis said that the Israelis I spoke to, and these were official Israelis, they were government officials, most of them were defense and intelligence people. They said that they actually preferred Assad, and this was Hafez al-Assad back in the day, because the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. And it seems to me that now, all these years later, those devils are so much worse than they were in 1992 when I was there, that it would make more sense for the Israelis to try to be propping up Bashar al-Assad than to try to topple him, because it would be so easy for a radical group like ISIS, Daesh, to spill over the borders and to cause the Israelis problems that they haven't even thought of yet. And what would it do to the stability of Jordan, for example, which Israel relies on for its own security in the east?
Well, actually, the former Israeli ambassador to Washington, Michael Oren, addressed this question several years ago, and in a very honest interview, and he said flat out, we prefer the bad guys who aren't associated with Iran to the bad guys who are. In other words, he said explicitly, Syria is the crucial link in the arc of resistance from Iran through Syria, through parts of Iraq to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Syria is the crucial link in that arc of resistance, and that's what they wanted to undermine. And they would be more happy attacking ISIS on their border and eliminating terrorists, creating chaos in Syria. We've seen chaos in several countries. We saw it break out in Iraq. We've seen it in Libya. And the amazing thing is the West doesn't seem to care.
Right.
They created it, but how much accountability is there for that? I used to think that how could they keep doing this? And then it suddenly dawned on me, or it became clear, that short of putting in a Western-friendly government, they would prefer to have chaos to a government that's independent in any significant extent, which Gaddafi was. As much as he went along with the West, he made various agreements. He even supported Sarkozy, apparently. They were still hell-bent on overthrowing him, and he was killed on the streets, as we know, to the amusement of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, we came, we saw, he died, she said laughingly on videotape. The day he was lynched.
I mean,
he was lynched, 70-year-old head of state.
Right.
Anyway, Rick Sterling is our guest. Rick is talking to us from the San Francisco Bay Area. He's an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. I want to just ask you really quickly, Rick, because time is short, about 3 minutes left. Putin and Trump obviously met in Helsinki. There's all kinds of talk about it, but very little of it has to do with Syria, even though it seemed to me and seemed to us that those discussions between Putin and Trump, a big part of them may have been about Syria. And we also know that the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, has been in Moscow or meeting with his Russian counterpart several times over the past year to talk about Syria. At the level of colonels from the U.S. Army and the Russian military are talking as many as 10 times a day about issues, deconfliction issues in Syria. What's your take on all that?
Well, I'm glad you bring it up because I looked at Haaretz earlier today, the influential English language Israeli newspaper. They are just as hysterical, if not even more hysterical, than the mainstream media about the Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki. One of the articles is titled, "In Helsinki, Trump and Putin Just Ripped Europe Apart." Another one refers to Russian fascism. So the question is, what's going on here? And what's really going on here is there's an intense concern in Israel, as well as in the American and generally Western foreign policy establishment, that Trump is going to make more moves to get along with Russia and to basically suspend or make moves toward ending the U.S. intervention in the Middle East. I think that's a big factor here.
Let me ask you, we have 1 minute left. Putin is, and the Russian government is also, seems to have cultivated a friendlier relationship with Netanyahu and the Israeli government. Netanyahu was actually in the reviewing stands at May 9th Victory Day, where Russia remembers the Soviet victory over fascism in World War II. What about that piece to it, though?
Well, I think Netanyahu realizes that the U.S. empire is in decline, and there's about 20% of the Israeli population are Russian emigres. So there are a lot of connections. Putin is the diplomat. He's bringing together Turkey and Iran. He's negotiating with Netanyahu. At the end of the day, I think His real alliances are with Syria, are with Iran, are with China, but he is doing as much as he can to avoid the world blowing up in a conflagration sparked in the Middle East, and that's a good thing. But the hysteria about the discussions, I think What's really driving that is that the domination, the global domination by the United States with allies such as Saudi Arabia and Israel and the UK and France, that's what's being challenged. And I think if Trump concedes that, if he gives up that claim, those actions to world domination, that's really what's going on here behind the scenes, I believe.
Well, that was the voice of Rick Sterling. Rick joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. He's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.